It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Have you ever wanted to quit your job, leave the rat race behind and head back to the land? Maybe buy an old farmhouse or build a solar-powered tiny home and live self-sufficiently on a few acres of your very own. Generations before you have shared that dream.
Come on! Pidgey, come! Come! Pidgey, come!
The reality is a little more complicated.
We're leaving. I'll slip the door.
This is a great place to start. This is our barn. We're really pleased with our carrots this year. I have to pick a carrot.
Sorry, now that we're out, using through the winter, whereas, eating a lot of our summer.
This is McKenna Goodman. We're visiting her homestead in rural Vermont, where she and her husband confront the daily moral and ethical dilemmas of a sustainable lifestyle.
We did it right there, actually, right on that flat, shady spot by the children's playset. We just did enough for, two a month, two chickens a month to eat. When we were killing the chickens, my husband and I, it was so gruesome, because it's gruesome to kill an animal regardless of how used to it you get. Every time you do it, you think, is this right? The ethics of what you're doing are always, at least for me, the horror of death is there. And yet it was so routine for us and so calm and so quiet. And I thought, on the one hand, we've gotten so good at this. This is so peaceful. Yeah. And then on the other hand, I was like, wow, this is like what the Nazis must have felt like. And then they thrash a lot because it's the nerve endings, but they're dead instantly. But the thrashing feels like they're suffering. I don't establish a bond with a chicken, but I do establish a bond with sheep and cows. They're named and you scratch behind their ears. I don't know, the ethics of it still, I think if I can do it myself, at least I know that the animal that I'm eating did not die in anguish or live in anguish. And so it makes it better, but it's fraught. The whole thing's just fraught. It's always fraught.
McKenna Goodman moved to Vermont during the 2008 financial crash. She was a young, out-of-work publishing assistant, sick of New York, and looking for a fresh start. Today, she's a modern-day homesteader on 32 acres of rolling hills in central Vermont. The barn, a carpentry shop, chickens, occasional sheep, a vegetable garden, and an outdoor bathtub?
This is our hot tub. And so we fill it up with the hose and put a fire underneath.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah.
You just light a fire?
Yeah. And then you have to, sometimes it gets too hot. These are the little seats that you have to sit on so your butt doesn't burn. But the kids love to take baths out. All summer we kind of take baths out here.
That's so nice.
Yeah, it's Vermont. You gotta do it.
Steve and I first met McKenna and her husband Sam during the pandemic. A time when a lot of people were taking a renewed interest in the whole back-to-the-land thing.
It was a late September day, and we just had our first frost. But the garden still looked pretty lush.
Anyway,
oh my gosh, your garden, look what, it's gorgeous.
Well, this is the time where things are starting to,
Yeah.
Chard, kale, Brussels sprouts, lots of carrots, celery, more kale, asparagus that's gone to seed. We grew Abenaki flint corn for cornmeal. So that's cool. we've harvested most of our cabbage and made sauerkraut. Collards will last for a little while. You can see with the first frost, the tomatoes all died.
This dream of being totally self-reliant on your own land has a long and complicated history, going back to Emerson and Thoreau, in 19th century utopian farming communities, and then to the hippie communes and back to the landers of the 60s and 70s, who believed the American way of life was corrupt, even broken.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with The Good Life by Helen and Scott Nearing. They are kind of the pioneers of a certain type of back to the land movement in this country that began in 1932 when they moved to Vermont. And I read their book for the first time when I moved to Vermont, and then I worked at the publishing house that publishes a lot of their work, and I've been to their homestead, and what they stood for, on the one hand, is like everything that I want to believe, and on the other hand, it's actually quite fraught. This is stable.
Oh my God, this is beautiful. Wow.
Sam built this.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, a little history. Scott Nearing was a radical economist and anti-war activist who got fired from a couple of teaching jobs during the First World War. Later, he joined the Communist Party and for years was a prominent figure on the left. But by his early 50s, he'd fallen out with the Workers' Party and was still blacklisted from universities.
And he kept getting booted out of, basically just shut down by the establishment for being too radical. He met Helen, who was this sort of aristocratic woman, a lot younger than him. They got together and they moved to Vermont and built up this really intentional, ethically minded, hard work, rooted in politics experiment that they called the Vermont Project, basically, where for 25 years they lived with the season. They built their house and their barn of stone. They grew all their own food. They didn't butcher animals.
It all sounds idyllic, but McKenna believes there's a deep contradiction in what the Nearings stood for. In many ways, they led exemplary lives, living simply and self-sufficiently, and they also thought anyone could do this as long as they were debt-free and healthy, or as Scott put it, had the necessary vigor. But McKenna says their gospel of the good life reeks of class privilege. The Nearings had money to buy their land and the means to leave the city and move to the country. As she puts it, to live without money, you had to have money.
Everything they did was about a binary, actually. They were against capitalism, and to them, capitalism was defined by the city, by what they called this grind, money, commerce, the ugliness of the factory and how it oppressed the worker. That was city, that was bad. And then country was good, and country was space and air and freedom and liberation through work.
As if there was no capitalism, no property issues and all of that in the country.
Right. Standing here today, in fact, I woke up this morning and I was really just in awe of the beauty of where I live and the injustice of the fact that I get to live here. And it's not guilt. It's like, what is it in this society, in this capitalist system that says, I can live here. I get to live here, and black men are being shot in front of their children for no reason. And here I am in paradise. And I think to myself, well, you know, I'm living the good life as far as what the Nearings would have said. And yet, what good have I done lately? I'm building topsoil, sure. I'm not spreading pesticides, great. I live so intentionally. It's such hard work to cut your own firewood, you know, etc. And so what does that mean? If it's hard for me, it's impossible. Like, this land is not available for most of society. Anyway, so I've been thinking about the whole idea of going back to nature and back to the land as this inherently classist, white supremacist social system that perpetuates systems of dominance while sort of hiding behind an ethical virtuosity that says, no, this is actually what it looks like to be closer to humanity.
What I find so interesting about what you're saying is you're saying there's clear injustice there for all kinds of deep historical and political reasons.
But you don't feel guilty about this.
Well, I don't think guilt is that useful unless it leads to action. I think that I see a lot of people feeling bad about the access and the privilege that they have. And I guess it's good to be aware of it. But if you stew in your own self-loathing for too long, it's just more stewing. It doesn't actually redistribute anything.
This whole business of returning to the land is once again a hot issue because Vermont, like so many rural areas, is experiencing a COVID-19 land rush. The summer we were there, the local real estate market went bonkers. Battered farmhouses and 10-acre plots were selling faster than realtors could list them. People were making cash offers for properties they hadn't even seen. These weren't local buyers. They were affluent city folk from New York and Boston and the Bay Area. People fleeing the city. That's a familiar story to McKenna.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay, so it was yesterday where I was thinking about the Nearings and how when they came to Vermont, it was 1932. And I have skipped over that fact so many times. I'm like, yeah, the 30s, the Great Depression, sure, yeah, whatever. And then I'm thinking, 1932, the Depression beginning, Hitler rising to power in Germany, a looming world war. And they said, let's get out of here. And they could. The decision that they made was a retreat.
Do you need to do anything with the chickens here?
No,
okay. I'm curious.
Yes.
Are you going to write anything about the Nearings? Because you should.
I am.
I figured.
I mean, I also was thinking about it when I wrote The Shame, too. Like, it's all in there, actually.
So the other thing to know about McKenna is that she's a writer. Her debut novel, called The Shame, recently created quite a buzz and popped up on several end-of-year best-of lists. It's the story of a young mother and aspiring writer living in rural Vermont who feels trapped. She fantasizes about running away and becomes fixated on a woman living in Brooklyn who she imagines has the perfect life. McKenna says it's not autobiographical, but the story is clearly drawn from her own background. Here's the book's prologue.
Imagine you're in the middle of the state of Vermont, on a tiny island the size of a shoebox. Around you is a lake of boiling lava, so hot that it burns up anything it touches. In one hand, you have an endlessly replenishing supply of undercooked egg whites and a straw. This will keep you alive for a long and unhappy life. At the edge of the lava, miles and miles away, the heat ends, and there is a lush and beautiful forest, meadows with wildflowers, bubbling brooks with salmon and little icicles and wild mint. There you can eat whatever you want. There you can eat pasta with clams, pasta with cheese, pasta with toppings unlike anything you could imagine. And there are salads with every possible ingredient and really good dressing, all of which will be available for the rest of your long and happy life. But to get to this magical place, you have to cross the hot lava. And you can't have a flying machine. Would you do it? How would you do it? Here's how I would do it. I'd take my gun, because you didn't say I couldn't have one. I'd take my gun, and I would look up in the sky, and I would see a giant flock of migrating geese. I'd put my egg whites down on the shoebox island and aim my gun and shoot a goose, which would fall down into the lava beside me. Because of the size of the goose, only the bottom half would burn instantly, and I'd have 2 seconds to use the top half as a stepping stone. By this time, I would have already shot down a second goose. As one foot lifted off the first bird, the other foot would be landing on the second, and by then I'd have shot down a third. I'd be in a spree of shooting geese one by one, rapid fire, and dead geese would be raining down on me, dropping into the lava in a line, and I'd be hopping from one to the next while shooting down more. And this would go on for hours and hours, until finally, I would have shot down the very last goose, which would take me to the edge of the hot lava. And I would jump safely onto the shore of the bountiful pasta and salad forest and live happily ever after.
I heard somewhere that you actually wrote the first draft totally in secret.
Yeah. It was not on purpose. It was just private. I was on maternity leave. I was at home with my second baby. The first baby was at daycare. My husband was at work. And I was completely insulated in this space. And I would write when I wasn't taking care of the baby. I felt like motherhood and early childhood, you know, like having little children and homesteading, it was like being in this dark, dark room. And I knew that there was a door, but I couldn't see the door. But I knew it was there. And it was through writing where I realized that these things that I had been obsessed with or interested in actually were all related.
So I have to ask you about the title of the book, The Shame. What is the shame, then?
I think it's many things. I think it's the shame of feeling like a bad mother. It's the shame of being a part of a system that you cannot extricate yourself from, or to know what you should do and to not do it anyway. And the shame of rage, the shame of being human, actually.
Can I just say this is a very high ethical standard that you are setting for yourself?
Well, I don't know. Yeah.
So what do we do then?
Well, I think that I'm also not a complete pessimist in the sense that when I get to that place, I think about the soil and rootedness and what happens in the soil and the kind of vibrations and cellular, mycorrhizal, bacterial networks that are happening. And I think that there is actually solace in nature. I mean, I don't leave this land very much. And so it is very much rooted in repetition of being here. You know, like in the spring, garlic is such an important crop for me because it's the first thing that pokes up in the spring. You plant the bulb right around October and it comes up and you're like, I've never seen green before. And there it is, you know? And then every different bit of green that comes up, you're like amazed that life exists, that life can persist. And I just am always so grateful for being alive in the spring. Anyway, I think as much as I say nature is fraught or like living close to nature is fraught, it's actually very spiritually important for me. And I feel like the wall of my skin is very porous. So being here is very important for me.
Carrots are really fussy.
McKenna Goodman lives on 32 acres of rolling hills in Verchères, Vermont. She is a writer and a high school English teacher. Her debut novel is called The Shame, and she did wind up writing about Helen and Scott Nearing. If you're interested, check out her New York Review of Books essay. The link's on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, Simon Winchester traces the history of owning property back to its origins. How far back could you trace it?
A long, long way back.
You're talking about the original people who lived here.
That's the point. These were the Mohicans.
I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
Thank you.
As a journalist, Simon Winchester spent decades on the road, reporting from Belfast to Bangladesh to all over southern China. When he was 55, he decided it was time to settle somewhere permanently. He bought a little house in Wassaic, a village north of New York City, and he started writing what would become a string of best-selling books. And then, when a neighbor offered him a good price on 100 acres of forest land, he said, sure, why not?
It was interesting, but not very useful land, insofar as it was mostly on the north slope of a mountain, and so you couldn't really grow very much. But it had a lot of, it had little streams, and it had a lot of wonderful trees, a variety of animals. So I had the land, but didn't really think a great deal about it.
Until some years later, when he went through the formal process of becoming an American citizen, his feelings about that chunk of land changed.
Then I became very much more emotionally connected with the realization that I now was fully invested in this country. I had a part of it. I mean, a tiny, tiny part, 100-odd acres in a country which has billions of acres. But nonetheless, it gave me a feeling that I was truly part of this country.
And that's when Simon Winchester began to wonder where that mystique came from.
And certainly one can fall to one's knees and sift the earth through one's fingers and say, this is mine, and this tree and that stream and that rock, they belong to me. But then I began to think, what on earth does that actually mean? And what did it mean to the people that had owned it before me? So I started looking in the archives, the various title exchanges in previous transactions.
How far back could you trace it?
A long, long way back. Back to when it ceased to be written in English, and those who were selling it, and I use that in the loosest possible manner, could not write, and so they had a little X or a little picture of a deer or some kind of animal.
You're talking about the original people who lived here.
That's the point. These were the Mohicans. And so I began to think, well, what was the Mohicans' attitude? Did they fall to their knees and sift the earth through their fingers and say, this is mine? And the answer is, of course, no, they didn't, because individual land ownership was incomprehensible to Native Americans in the way that it is to this day to Australian Aboriginals and New Zealand Maoris. The community owns the land, the tribe, the band, the family, no individual. You can no more own the land, said, I think it was Chief Sealthynner, that you can no more own the land than you can own the breeze or the ocean.
The depressing part is that people who believe land can be shared but never owned, it seems like they always get wiped out, and usually brutally, over and over again in India and Africa, wherever the British Empire went, and of course, most notably, to this country's everlasting shame, on this continent. And on a scale that's kind of hard to comprehend, the government seizure of land in this country is, it's overwhelming.
It's completely monstrous. I mean, I mentioned that the people who initially signed the deeds over to the Dutch were the Mohicans. There are no Mohicans here to this day. Where are they? They're in Wisconsin, living in relative poverty. They have a representative who comes every year, 1,300 miles east, to essentially mourn over the lands that they lost for no good reason other than that white people wanted to settle them. These are the original inhabitants. It's their country. We white people, we're their guests.
Yeah. I think there can be a lot of different ways to define ownership. But what does it mean legally to own land, fundamentally?
Well, going to the actual fundamentals, in Western countries, the ultimate owner of land is God. In Britain, where I come from, the Queen is the legal representative, if you like, of God on earth. And so she owns, technically speaking, all of England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, the United Kingdom, every acre.
Wait, really? In the US, does President Biden own the land?
No, because this is a secular country and the president isn't the representative of God. But, I mean, I pay taxes on my land, and if I don't pay taxes, the land ultimately is taken away from me by the town, the community, the county, the state, whoever. So do I own it, or do I actually lease it? Mm-hmm. It's a confusing situation. But once you've got it, you have what's called the bundle of rights. And the bundle of rights, you can sell the land, you can do with it what you wish, you can mine, cut down trees, and, crucially in this context, ban other people from it.
It seems like every battle we've had about land flows from that concept.
Yes, but then if you're a diehard communist and you believe that all ownership is theft, the land that I own is theoretically should belong, if belonging is the term, to the Mohicans. I've stolen it. There's been a long chain of people in between me and the First People, but nonetheless, I shouldn't own it.
Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington. The prosperity of early Virginia derived from her soil.
I hadn't realized until reading your book how baked into the foundation of this country the lust for land was. You portray George Washington in a way that's very different than the way, you know, we tend to. He often gets portrayed as, of the founding fathers, the good guy, the one who freed his slaves, you know, after his death.
Right.
Yeah, but you tell a different story about him as being motivated primarily by lust for land.
He had tremendous lust for land. I mean, he was a surveyor, so he knew how to stake out tracts of land. And when he fought in the French and Indian Wars, he was given, or saw to it that he won, large tracts of land in the Ohio Valley.
And this land he had, it was, what, like 32,000 acres or something huge. Did he kick the people who had been living there off his land?
No, to be fair, he didn't, as far as we know, anyway. And then King George, bless his soul, largely as a result of the land grabbing which people like Washington were doing west of the Appalachians, the king said no further white settlement. He didn't use the word white, but no settlement, further colonial settlement, west. It didn't last for very long. That's not going to stop a country impelled by manifest destiny. So the land grabbing went on and on and on.
One of the worst moments, and just surreal, you describe as the Oklahoma land grab.
Yes, it's oddly familiar to me because when I was 17, I actually lived in Oklahoma. And so this was very much riven into the character and knowledge of all Oklahomans, but is very little known beyond that. And so it was in April, I think, 1893, on the northern border and on the eastern border, where the Native Americans were settled, thousands upon thousands of people, Europeans, mainly new settlers in this country, lined up, mostly on horses, some with Conestoga wagons. And then at noon on that particular, I think it was a Monday, the 22nd of April, they blew their bugles and they raised their flags and everyone rushed off like the beginning of the Kentucky Derby, thundering down across the plains. And then when they saw somewhere that they thought was attractive, leapt off, plunged their stake into the ground, said, "This is mine," raced to the tent, which was the US government land office, paid their $5 registration fee, which is all they needed, and then they owned the land. The place that I'm particularly interested in is a place called Guthrie. At 6 o'clock in the morning of that day, the population of Guthrie, zero. At 6 o'clock that night, 15,000. It was the fastest growing town in American history. By 3 days later, the Telegraph had been persuaded to have a link there. There was a macadamed road about 9 days later. Electricity, primitive electricity, was brought very shortly thereafter. And it became briefly the capital of the territory. And the person that planned it all, after he had done the urban planning for Guthrie, moved west to California and founded another place, which has endured rather longer, Hollywood.
Yes, this is Hollywood, the city of the stars, the famous, the fabulous, the glamorous Hollywood.
were talking about how land ownership is, you know, in many ways, fundamentally, the right to kick somebody else off of what you say is your property. And there's been a movement in England and Scotland, and I think before that in Scandinavia, that pushes back against this notion of trespass. There's actually new legislation in the UK, isn't there, that gives everybody the right to access the land?
In the UK, up to a point. In Scotland, yes. I mean, but the history of this goes back some hundreds of years to Sweden, Norway, Finland to an extent, and Denmark. The concept in the Swedish language is allemansrätten, all men's right to the land. The law says, providing you behave yourselves, and there is a sort of codified code of conduct, which is all entirely reasonable. I mean, you don't let off tactical weapons on the land. You don't pop into someone's garden and demand a cup of coffee. But providing you behave yourself, you can camp, you can fish, you can walk, you can run, you can do more or less what a civilized person would wish to do on land, no matter who owns it.
You can just go camp anywhere?
Anywhere. You have an absolute right to do so. Not in a person's
backyard.
You can't, as I say, go into a backyard. But if they own, as I did in Dutchess County, 100-odd acres, and someone decides, well, this looks pretty, I'll go and put up my tent and take water from the stream and fish for trout in the stream and cook them, I have no recourse.
What if they decide they just want to live in their little camp there forever, and then they invite some of their relatives, and soon you have 12 people living on your land in little camps?
That's a good question. I think if push came to shove, you could go to law, but they don't do that sort of thing in Sweden.
It's so un-American. I mean, I'm trying to imagine what it would take for that to happen in the US.
Well, if I can get on my hobby horse for a moment, there's in America, the big landowners traditionally, particularly the Western ones, and Ted Turner is, I suppose, well, not suppose, he is the biggest, large tracts of Idaho, Colorado, Montana, Wyoming. He owns it, but he doesn't enforce any trespass laws. But there's this couple of brothers called the Wilkes brothers who have arisen to a position of some notoriety in recent years. They come from far west Texas. They are super conservative evangelical Christians. Mm. And they developed a formula for fracking chemicals, which sold incredibly well and made them millionaires. So these two young men went on a shopping spree for land like no other, and they've thus far accumulated about 750,000 acres.
Wow.
But the crucial difference is that they don't allow people to access. They put up gates, they put up security cameras, they've hired guards, and one might say they're being dog and mangerish about it. There's no particular plan they have other than to say, you can't go on it because I own it. And Westerners think this is going against the spirit of the West.
I think it's time for the Idaho legislature to protect public property rights. That road has been built by the public, maintained by the public. It belongs to the public, and the Wilkes brothers are stealing from the public.
I mean, this is how people created countries originally. You grab some land and you put up some guards or bring in your knights or whatever and prepare to defend it.
Indeed, and there's a great deal in this book about the international scene and the story of the partition of India and Pakistan, or the partition of Palestine, or the creation of Northern Ireland. When you think about it, the Indian-Pakistan border, 1,700 miles long, astonishingly carefully guarded, is merely the linear descendant of a man with a plow creating furrows in a field in Wiltshire in, let's say, the Bronze Age, and his neighbour creating furrows which go in a slightly different direction. And where the two sets of furrows meet, they put a line of stones or a line of wattle or a little trench or something to mark the border, the boundary between two pieces of land. Well, that idea of a boundary then becomes between two fields and then between two communities and then two counties and then two countries and then between civilizations and they become frontiers, and thus is the world divided.
Yeah. Last question. Has researching this book changed anything about your own personal relationship to land? Do you still own any?
Well, I do. I'm sitting here in a farm in western Massachusetts. It's about 5 acres, which I was cutting the rhubarb and gathering the eggs this morning. But I think when I pass on, it's going to be deeded to a local conservation group so that my heirs and successors, such as they are, will no longer own it. And the town, everyone who lives here, will be able to access it. It will be owned communally, as indeed it was 200 years ago.
Do your heirs object?
No, they don't. I think they accept the argument. I mean, they'll get a bit of spending money. So no, they don't care too much.
Right. So they can go out and buy their own land.
I hope they don't.
Simon Winchester has written more than a dozen books, including The Professor and the Madman and The Map That Changed the World. And we were talking about his most recent, called Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. Coming up, the question we're asking this hour, whose land is it?
Canada and the United States exist because of the theft of Indigenous land and the partial destruction of Indigenous communities. I think that there's this stereotype, and it's really not a stereotype, it's a narrative for both Canada and the United States that first, this was empty land. When settlers came here, there was no one really here using the land productively. The people that were here using the land productively were really just savages that deserved to be kicked out of the way to make way for civilization.
The Treaty of 1851 covers North Dakota. This is treaty land.
I think that is a bedrock foundational narrative. When you read the, you know, news stories about Standing Rock, there's still these narratives that these are troublemakers, that these are angry Indians.
Clearly, they're acting outside the law. They're trespassing on private property. They're burning cars. They're throwing rocks and bottles at law enforcement officers.
Ultimately, that's a stereotype to mask this theft.
Inside the Land Back Movement, next. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. When white Europeans first came to this continent, they began seizing land and forcing native inhabitants out. Maybe they didn't think of it as theft. But if the same thing happened today,
we would not hesitate to call it stealing, and we would want whatever was taken returned. Land back is a movement that demands exactly that, the return of native lands to native people. That could mean handing over property rights, or it could mean restoring stewardship of ancestral territories, or redistributing wealth back to indigenous communities, or all of the above. Land back is a growing movement in the U.S. and even more so in Canada. Charles Monroe Kane reached out to one of its leaders, Hayden King. He's the executive director of the Yellowhead Institute and Anishinaabe from Beausoleil First Nation in Ontario.
You know, land has a legal meaning. It's about ownership. It also has cultural and historic meanings. What does land mean to you?
I try to refer back to Anishinaabeg thought and philosophy and importantly language when I'm thinking about land. And, you know, the English language sort of trains you to think about land as this static concept and almost as a commodity, something that you own or something that you buy or sell or something that you extract resources from. But in our language, Anishinaabemowin, the word for land is commonly referred to as aki or aki, but the root of that is actually akina. And you talk to elders and they do the translation work and they say that the closest literal translation to that is everything in unity. And so when you think about land on those terms as this unifying force, as the thing that binds us all and connects us all, then you start thinking in land in different terms. In a lot of indigenous languages and philosophies and indigenous law, certainly Anishinaabeg law, land is something that is alive and has agency and certainly must be respected. And that includes respecting maybe even the sovereignty and self-determination of land. So that's how I like to think about land. But, you know, I would be lying if I didn't say that that takes work, right? This is sort of part of the decolonizing that we all need to do in our relationship to land.
You know, when you read about the land back movement, you find a bunch of word associations. You just brought one up. Decolonization, there's also reparations, reconciliation. It seems like land back is a lot more than just, you know, giving land back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, probably the single loudest demand among Indigenous people since the relationship to settlers emerged was this demand for land back from land theft and from dispossession. And I think that that's entirely valid. We want to get land back. Mm-hmm. Almost universally, that's what Indigenous people will say. But land back is also a lot more than that. It's also about revitalizing Indigenous life. Because if we're thinking about land as everything in unity, and we're thinking about our languages connected to the land, and our culture connected to the land, and our family and social organizations connected to the land, then land back is this broader movement towards revitalizing Indigenous life.
I want to ask a question, and I don't mean it to be so elementary you're going to scoff at it or to be even painful for you. But I think we need to remind people, like, this was your land. How did you lose it?
The language that I might use is, you know, how is it taken away as opposed to lost?
No, yeah, that's better. Okay.
You know, it's clear that the discussion is a lot about words that we use. And I think that this is an important one because the sort of principal institution between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in Canada and the United States is the treaty. And in the Canadian context, treaties were made around the time of Confederation. So they're very much these nation-building tools that allowed for the settlement of the country. And I think that it's not that dissimilar in the United States, though I think in Canada, sort of treaties were made prior to settlement. In the United States, treaties were made sort of after settlement. But as these nation-building tools, really, in retrospect, they were, you know, vehicles of dispossession in many ways. And as states and provinces and territories sort of legitimized their rule, Indigenous perspectives were marginalized. And that sort of hoped for collaborative relationship disappeared. And states started working towards eliminating the political threat that Indigenous peoples presented to those states and provinces and entire countries. And so that meant things like assimilation policies and Indian wars and residential schools, industrial schools, boarding schools, and then this very long period of suppression of Indigenous political difference. So in a lot of ways, what you're seeing now with the revitalization of the land back movement, this is, you know, a century coming. It's not necessarily that we're asking the Canadian government for the land back and the Canadian government is, you know, sure, we'll give you the land back. It's more of confronting state power, police, resource companies, corporations, putting our bodies in the path of bulldozers. I mean, you saw it at Standing Rock. In a lot of ways, that forces confrontation, but it also forces negotiation.
I read your report and a bunch of stuff online as I got really into it. There's been a lot of success. I was reading about the Nunavut Land Claims Agreement, and the other one I cannot pronounce, but it's the Tsilhuntin Nation versus British Columbia in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Correct me if I'm wrong, didn't those claims give sovereignty to the land?
Yeah, those are two really different examples. So
okay,
in the Nunavut case, the Inuit in the far north of Canada approached the government and said, listen, we've never created a treaty with you. You're illegally squatting on our land. So let's create a treaty and figure out what our relationship is to one another. And in that case, the federal government had been compelled by a court decision to make treaties where there were no treaties, because as the courts effectively agreed with Indigenous people in Canada that where there are no treaties, people are illegally squatting. They didn't say it in those terms, but effectively they agreed with that perspective. And so Canada was forced to make new treaties. Now, one of the core elements of the modern treaty process, and the example like Nunavut, is that the Indigenous community has to do what's called extinguishing title, or surrendering their rights and title to land in exchange for the treaty. So they have to give up 90% of the land to keep 10% of the land. Or in the Nunavut case, they got to keep 18% of the land, but they had to surrender 82% of the land. So it's not exactly an equal distribution of land in these new treaties.
Yeah, it doesn't sound equal. Right.
So in the Chilcotin case, the other case that you're referencing, this community in the province of British Columbia decided they weren't interested in surrendering their title. So they decided instead, we want to keep that title and we're going to fight Canada all the way to the Supreme Court so that we get our title recognized, our land. And that's what they did. And they were, by and large, successful. And so the Chilcotin, they charted a completely different path than the Inuit in Nunavut. I think there's positive and negatives, I suppose you could say, with each of those approaches. But that's an ongoing debate.
It's fascinating. You know, I when I was a kid, my family lived in Alaska. I had a brief stayover, you know, a week, 2 weeks, in Wood Buffalo National Park. There was an activist, young activist. He was in an interview. And just as an aside, he said, the least they could do was give us the national parks.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the parks. What about having them being turned over?
You know, the history of the park system in the United States and Canada is a pretty violent one. Some of the first parks in the United States, you know, Yosemite and Yellowstone, were created under this belief that people were separate from nature and were separate from wildlife. So the Indigenous people that lived in these places where parks were proposed to be created, they had to be relocated, right? They had to be removed. And so in Canada, the first provincial park in the province that I live, Ontario, is called Quetico Provincial Park. And the government forced Indigenous people in those parks to leave. And in fact, one of the communities that they forced to leave was declared extinct 20 years later. And so now there is, I think, a latent movement towards talking about co-managing some of those lands. There's a park in Labrador, a park in Northwest Territories, where Indigenous people have significant involvement in how those parks are managed. But if you're asking me if I think handing over these parks to Indigenous peoples exclusively and having the management of those spaces is a good idea, I think that yes, absolutely it is. And I think practically, if you're interested in the land back movement from like a policy, a legal perspective, are you going to go to private landowners and tell them they have to give their land back to Indigenous people? Or maybe are you going to look at some of these vast areas of federal lands that could be transferred to Indigenous people and have those folks manage them? I think that that's a wonderful idea and I support it wholeheartedly.
Okay. There's a lot of things in the courts. There's a lot of things spinning around. If I'm looking at the map of Canada, what would change if the land back movement was successful?
You know, the vision of Indigenous people, or at least the Anishinaabeg people, has always been looking at the land as the sort of basket or a bowl. And we all live in that bowl, and we share the spoon, and we pass it to one another, and we eat from it together. And so there's nothing in Anishinaabeg perspective about living on the land with other people that has to be exclusive. And sometimes we can get stuck in that when we look at maps. You know, this is one jurisdiction's territory, and this is another jurisdiction's territory. But moving towards an Indigenous approach to our relationship to the land might mean that the map has many layers.
Right.
It has those layers of provinces and territories, but it also has those layers of, you know, Anishinaabeg governance of the Great Lakes. And that exists. There's lines on lines on lines.
Right. Basically. And maps can be three-dimensional.
Yeah, I think through time and space, absolutely. And it's less about who owns the land, and it's more about how you relate to the land.
I have a final question for you. And this is an uncomfortable question, I think, for someone in your position. Do you have hope? Mm. Are you going to get your land back? Is it going to work out?
Yeah, I mean, I will always have hope in Indigenous youth who are leading this movement and Indigenous communities that are really paving the way. And I feel light when I talk about language revitalization with my ancestors, or I go hunting.
Uh-huh.
So absolutely, that gives me hope. And, you know, you get drawn into the fights that we have with resource companies and state governments, and it can certainly take you into a dark place and question your neighbors and your friends. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, I think Indigenous people are leading and showing the way. And for me, that's hopeful.
Hayden King is Anishinaabe from Beausoleil First Nation in Chinmising in Ontario. He's the executive director of the Yellowhead Institute and co-author of the seminal Yellowhead Red Paper, Land Back. And if you'd like to know whose land you're on, check out the online map created by the folks at Native Land Digital. You can search it by zip code or address, so it's a really great place to begin. To find out more, visit our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is made each week by a tiny team of audio producers: Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Angelo Bautista, Mark Rickers, Joe Hartke, Steve Paulson, and me, Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening, and come back often. Thank you.